Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 1983, features Nobel economist Milton Friedman and seven young adults discussing our government's potential to act as an agent for social change. This program is presented in three segments: beneficiaries, bureaucrats, and politicians. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
We must keep the rate of growth of government spending at reasonable and prudent levels.
Candidate Reagan advocated less government.
We must reduce personal income tax rates and accelerate and simplify depreciation schedules in an orderly, systematic way to remove disincentives to work, savings, investment, and productivity.
Candidate Reagan advocated cuts in federal taxes.
We must review regulations that affect the economy and change them to encourage economic growth.
Candidate Reagan advocated reducing government intervention in the economy.
We must establish a stable, sound, and predictable monetary policy.
Candidate Reagan advocated moderate and stable growth of the economy.
Thank you very much.
And the voters responded by giving Candidate Reagan an overwhelming mandate when he was elected president. President Reagan tried to keep his promises, but like most presidents, he was only partly successful. Economist Milton Friedman explains why this occurred. He discusses a political phenomenon, tyranny of the status quo.
Everywhere, whether in the United States, Great Britain, France, or Germany, a new administration has just about 6 months to make major changes that will benefit the community at large. Those changes will have bad effects on small concentrated groups. The bad effects will be visible and immediate. The good effects will be less visible, take longer to manifest themselves, and longer to be recognized. Unless the occupant of that house, Republican or Democrat, makes such changes in the first few months after being elected or reelected, the tyranny of the status quo will assert itself and prevent further change.
In Tyranny of the Status Quo, we will examine government's potential to act as an agent for change. Joining Dr. Friedman are young adults from throughout the United States. These men and women will share the rewards or suffer the consequences of today's political decisions. Like all of us, they want improvements in our society. Like all of us, they have many different ideas as to how those improvements can be achieved.
I would like for us to explore the problem of why is it that what I assert to be a distinct change in public opinion has not succeeded in changing actual policy. What is it about the tyranny of the status quo? What is it about the role of pressure groups? What is it that has produced this result? And I would like to attack that problem, that issue, by discussing some of the broad areas of policy that have been very much in the forefront and have been very important in the past 2 years. We have, as you know, in this country, a very large expenditure of governmental funds on higher education in the form of state universities, which are financed out of state or maybe city or local groups, also in the form of federal subsidies to higher education, directly to the institutions, and indirectly to students in the form of subsidized loans of various kinds, grants, also grants without condition. And the question I want to raise is whether those higher education expenditures are a justifiable activity of government and what their consequences are, whether they really are a desirable element of a welfare state. I may say my own view has always been very simply that they are not, the reason being that in the main, the benefits go to the individuals who get the higher schooling, the students on the one hand, that those students tend to be in the middle or upper income groups. Either their parents are from that group or they themselves will be in that group when they get out, whereas the funds come from people all over, so that you have a case in which you are imposing taxes on relatively low income people to confer very large benefits on upper income people.
I agree that I think the subsidies are regressive and that the wrong people are paying for it. On the other hand, I think there are some sectors of the world which economics should stay out of. and which private interests should stay out of. And I think education is one. I think as soon as you start offering people economic incentives to get educated or to use the education that they get for economic means, in other words, once you put a price tag on knowledge, I think you're going to be...
What are you talking about? You mean to say that the graduates of colleges and universities don't use their capacities in the direction which is influenced by the incomes they can earn?
Not completely, no.
Oh, but neither do the people who don't go to college. Nobody is completely dominated by the highest income. So right. In what respect, in what way do you think that governmental financing of higher education in any way changes the incentives to which the individuals who get the education react?
Well, it's hard to talk about this without having the possibilities before us. Let me tell you, one possibility I've heard is that people would, in effect, invest in me. If I went to college, somebody would say, he's probably going to do well, so we'll pay him to go to college. And then as he makes money, he'll pay us back. And it's a good investment. That gives, first of all, they're going to judge people not on how well they get educated, but how well they're going to do after college. So right there, I think that's a subversion of the educational process.
Let's stop for a moment.
Okay.
You think that the grantors of government higher education are judging the expenditure of that education by how good the education is? How do you explain the fact that the most eminent universities, disproportionately contributing to the Nobel laureates or other marks, are the non-governmental as opposed to the governmental institutions?
Well, I think private institutions are, in general, better, though certainly there are very good state institutions.
Well, I feel that there's a basic assumption that has to be challenged, and that's that the students by themselves benefit. If you believe that society places education as a goal worthy of attainment, and that by having a more educated society, society will benefit, then I feel that no one is losing out by having an individual going to a university and becoming a professional.
Let me ask you a question. Did society benefit from the development of the microcomputer industry in the Silicon Valley?
I feel that every step
taken forward, society
does benefit
from. Did society benefit from that?
I'm not familiar with that one example.
Well, did society benefit from Henry Ford's introduction of the Model T Ford?
Yes, I think it did.
Should the society therefore have subsidized Henry Ford to produce a Model T?
Subsidy, see, that issue is not really relevant to the issue at hand.
Why not? This is a subsidy.
But if you use the example of education, sticking with higher education, the assumption has been made that there are a group of people who are giving and are not receiving in return. I think that is false, because although there are a group of individuals who are poor and they may be taxed and these taxes go towards financing someone's education, they are not losing out because society is benefited by having
poor people who indeed do attain education. Excuse me, that's my whole point. Society was benefited by Henry Ford's producing it. The poor people you're talking about benefited by Henry Ford's doing it. And yet you do not believe that government should have used compulsory taxation to generate that benefit. Where's the difference?
If it had to get the Henry Ford's achievements, if it had to get to
in those states,
then I think,
those
yeah, sure,
well,
should
let's
have.
Go back. Let's look at the evidence.
Okay.
If you look at collectivist states like Russia, China, they are states which use the same means for getting the Henry Fords that they use to finance higher education. And what kind of Henry Fords do they get? But I want to stick to this component of the welfare state, higher education. How do you justify using tax funds? Do you suppose, let's suppose you did not have any tax funds. Would there be institutions of higher education?
Yes, there would be, but you would have a different brand of people going there.
How do you know?
The ones who would benefit would be those who are wealthy and can afford it. As it stands now, in America, which
sure
is the greatest
that?
Thing about America in my mind, you can go to a college and go to an institution of higher learning without having to worry about finances because there are means available.
You are a very young man, Gary. Historically in the United States, people of every income class have been able to get through college and universities, whatever the income of their parents. Now,
are you saying there's equal access?
No, I didn't say there's equal access. There are many respects in which people are not equal. And this is no different from others. The opportunity for a person to set up in a business is not independent of the wealth of his parents. It doesn't follow from that the government ought to set everybody up in business. What I'm trying to argue is that, as a matter of fact, historically, it has been possible, I speak personally, I come from a family, my parents never had an income which would have qualified for the poverty level by modern standards. And I've worked my way through college, and hundreds and thousands and millions of other people did the same thing. The question is, if you want to go to college, who should pay for it, you or somebody who isn't going to go to college?
It is in the best interest of every black individual, regardless of his station in life, to make sure that more blacks go to college and become professionals. Therefore, by using your logic, you would say by that one black person living in Harlem who does not have the funds available, he should not be made to give a dollar of his paycheck to go to a person who's going to college.
The right word is made. There have long been black colleges and universities supported in large part by contributions from the black community. That's a voluntary activity. The question at issue is whether it is appropriate to make them contribute.
I think it is appropriate, because that's something which I and a lot of other people deem as being very important.
Excuse me, for a moment, let's suppose you didn't go to Union College. You would have conducted some other career. You might have made even more money in that other career.
I may not be as influential. That's the key.
But you might have made more money in that. You might have had more funds to put back. You might have been more influential.
Oh.
The question is, why should I subsidize you in going to college, but not subsidize you for a moment in setting up a business?
As I stated, it depends on the goal of society.
Doesn't have goals. People have goals.
Well, people
you
make
have
up society.
Common goals, of course. But insofar as their goals are common, they can do it through voluntary contributions.
Why should factory workers, or why should a poor black factory worker have to work an extra hour a week in order to send any of us to college?
Well, there's good and bad points to everything, but just because others get on the bandwagon and also benefit does not mean that we should not allow those who are on the lower strata to benefit.
Not just others, it's most of the people who go to college are middle class.
There is no governmental program in the country which so clearly takes money from low-income groups and gives it to high-income groups.
But you're saying, you're making the assumption that you have a group of people who are in lower classes paying for the higher echelon. Well, the higher echelon doesn't really have to get the money to go to school.
I beg your pardon. Doesn't have to, of course.
They
but
have
it
other
does,
means.
But it does. But if I take the people who are going to Berkeley, here in California, the University of California, it's a state university, it doesn't have any tuition, it does have some fees. If you look at the average income of the parents of the people who are going there, this was done some time ago, in all the state universities in California, 50% of the students came from the upper 25% of the income class, and 5% of the students came from the bottom 25% of the.
Well, if that's the current state of affairs, then that is not fair. But that does not mean we should scrap the whole institution of government subsidizing education.
Well, you tell me how you would arrange the subsidies.
Well, I don't have any easy answers, but I still wouldn't say scrap the whole system. And I think that's where we differ.
It seems so happens that the oldest form of government subsidization education was for higher education. Mm-hmm. And it is inherent in higher education that it will, in fact, be regressive. But now, look, here you are defending, two of you at least, defending these welfare state payments to students going to institutions of higher education. Do you feel the same way about welfare for business?
I think if we can't get a great car through private industry, and it's, you know, if getting a good car is a good in itself, which it is, then we should federally fund it. Yeah.
And how are you going to, who is going to decide, and how are you going to decide whether government is more effective in doing that than private in the market itself?
It's not a question of who's more effective. I think I would agree that, especially in getting a good car, the private is always more effective. But we're taking a hypothetical case where the private market won't do it.
Well, let's not take hypothetical cases. Okay. Let's take real cases. For example, here is the Chrysler Corporation.
Right.
The government, in effect, bailed it out by guaranteeing it a loan. Should the government have guaranteed that loan?
And not on principle. I really can't defend it on principle. But the fact is that a tremendous amount of our population is reliant on the auto industry and on Chrysler in particular.
What would have happened if Chrysler had gone bankrupt?
I don't know.
Would have continued to operate. But it would have operated under a receiver. Mm-hmm. The people who would have been hurt would have been the people who owned Chrysler shares or who had loaned money to Chrysler. Mm-hmm. In fact, the odds are that the properties would have been taken over by more efficient automobile producers, and for all I know, you would have had more jobs for all. Now, the question is, that's why I say this is welfare. Mm-hmm. The Chrysler loan is a form of welfare to the people who own stock and bonds, just as government subsidies to higher education is a form of welfare for the students who are in higher education.
Government, nobody would argue that what we did to Chrysler we should do for every folding firm. Right. But I think government
only
has...
Only for the largest firms, then?
Only for the firms that can bounce back, as Chrysler did. And I think congressmen looked at that very closely before they voted for the grant or the loan. But I think government does have an opportunity to provide security. It's not fair to a Chrysler employee that he gets laid off and he gets impoverished because Lee Iacocca or somebody on the top of Chrysler made a mistake. So the government has the opportunity to offer him some security. And that's basically what we go to government for security.
But the government does provide a lot of that security by providing unemployment insurance, by providing all sorts of assistance for people who are put out of work.
So
the only question at stake here is whether he is in addition entitled to a job which brings in much more pay than the average American makes, producing products which nobody wants for the benefit of a multi-billion dollar
corporation. Again, you're switching it to industries that won't bounce back. In this case, we had an optimum use of security. He became secure, and at the same time, he got to work and contribute.
I don't see how we can know that it was optimum, because we don't know what would have happened with that plant if it had been broken up and divided under new management. It might be that other people in Lee Iacocca could have managed that plant much more effectively. And maybe the workers who would have been working for that management would be better off today than if they had stayed, you know, under Iacocca's management. In any event, I just don't see why the government should be supporting Lee Iacocca any more than it should be supporting, you know, middle-class college students.
The Great Depression of the 30s brought distress to the farm. Prices plummeted, surpluses accumulated. In response, government initiated subsidies to support the prices of farm products. They are still with us at an estimated cost to the American taxpayer of over $21 billion this year.
It was designed to be a short-term program to take care of our burdensome supplies and to raise commodity prices, and that's the reason I went into it.
Obviously, many farmers, big and small, real farmers and professionals quick to cash in on a good thing, have benefited from these programs. They would loudly protest the end of these benefits, but everyone else would reap both lower taxes and lower food bills.
We have higher productivity, and that should help the consumer. But the problem is that the government has intervened and put support on milk, which means they guarantee the price that is going to be paid for powdered milk and butter and cheese and things like that. And in doing this, the government has made it very profitable to produce milk, and we can produce all the milk we want. We know we're going to get a price for it. But we just keep producing, and we produce more and more and more. Therefore, we've generated a huge surplus, and the government can't afford to keep buying this surplus. And so I think in the end, the best thing would be for the government just to get out of it, allow supply and demand to take over. Of course, if there's too much milk, then the price is going to go down, and this is good for the consumer. If there's great demand for milk, then the price is going to go up, and we'll produce more.
Some farmers would just as soon get rid of the artificial prop of government support. But the tyranny of the status quo has so far prevented that from happening.
The welfare state is a many-headed giant. I was going to say monster, but I figured I'd better say giant. Now I want to turn to another head of the welfare state, and that is the subsidies to agriculture. Those are a major matter. They amounted in the last year to about $12 billion, if my memory serves me right. They have been getting larger rather than smaller. They go to subsidize people who produce everything from tobacco to dairy products to wheat to corn, you name it, and there's a subsidy program for them. Of course, it's not labeled subsidy. It's always labeled a price support program. And the form which it takes is that the government guarantees the farmer that if the price at which he can sell his product falls below a certain level, the government essentially buys up the surplus, buys up what can't be sold at that price and stores them. And as a result, we have mountains of goods, cheese, dairy products in storage. And it's worth noting that this is a phenomenon not only in the United States, but around much of the Western world. Europe has a butter mountain, which it's trying to dispose of, and so on. Now the question is what can we say about agricultural subsidies? Are they an appropriate element of a welfare state?
Well, it seems a little simple for those of us who have no experience in the with farmers to say that we're absolutely opposed to agricultural price supports. But I think that if we had a little bit more familiarity with what life was like when you were at the mercy of the weather and you had no idea whether you were going to be able to sell your crop from one year to another because you didn't know in advance what your crop was going to be like. It seems like something of a reasonable way to try to stabilize people's income source.
Well, if I understand your argument, you're saying that the government should provide crop insurance, which is a very different thing from price support.
How is it different?
Unemployment insurance is a very different thing from guaranteeing you a price for your labor.
Well, I guess that that might be a preferred alternative way to make sure that people were not going to starve when they had a bad year, when everyone had a good year. And
well,
they
if there's one thing that the farmers are pretty well protected against, it's
starving. Although they're losing their houses and their farms.
Yes, many of them are losing their houses. Because they have borrowed a great deal of money on the basis of their houses. We tend to think, you see, the image you people are projecting is the image that is common in the United States, for good reasons, of the small pioneer farmer on a small plot of land that is scraping the ground to earn a living. Now, in fact, the most farmers in the United States who are really commercial farmers have properties and assets that have to be measured in the millions of dollars, not in the tens of thousands of dollars.
One of the reasons that I presume that we provide those kinds of subsidies, and I think it's not always the case that they're referred to as something other than subsidies, is that we want to ensure that people stay in the business of agriculture and that there's a certain diversity of products available.
If we want to assure that people stay in the business of agriculture, we've been doing a lousy job because the number of people in agriculture has been declining drastically. You know, there's no industry in the United States which comes closer to being a high-tech industry. At the outset of the American Republic in 1776 or 8, it took 19 farmers to feed themselves and one other person, 95% of the population. Today, it takes less than one farmer to feed himself and 19 other persons.
Right. I understand. There have been, in fact, lots of small farmers dropping out of the business and the agricultural business remaining. Perhaps we could change to a more central question, which I have for you, which is that you characterize this as though the $12 billion which we spend in subsidies is a kind of loss, and that if we didn't spend that, we would be better off. And what I would like you to do is flesh that out a little bit.
Well, the effect of spending the $12 billion is mostly to induce farmers to spend money to grow crops which go into storage. Now, who benefits from that?
Or which might be, in fact, sold abroad.
Well, that's a more difficult problem. If we try to sell them abroad, we can only sell them at the world price. The world price is below the domestic support price. And so, in effect, the difference is precisely the subsidy that is being paid to farmers. Now, if we offer a higher price at home than is available in the world market, it has to take an act of government to export. See, let's suppose we had no price supports. We weren't spending this $12 billion. There would be the same price abroad and at home. You would have a world market for all of these products. And what wasn't sold at home would be sold abroad, and we would, in fact, be exporting at least as much as we're now exporting. In addition, however, the program makes food more expensive and imposes a cost on all of the people in the community who consume food. Agriculture is one of our major export industries. We have had a very large movement toward protection. And this carries us back to the automobile industry. Because here there is a very close connection. The argument is that Japanese automobiles have been coming into the country and taking jobs away from American workers in Detroit. And we ought to do something about it. We ought to impose a tariff on it, or we ought to impose a quota. Or what we have done is to have what's called a voluntary quota on the part of the exports from Japan. Now, the question is, that's another component of the welfare state. And what is there to say about that?
The underlying claim is that we would all be better off if there were no constraints placed on anything. And I think that a certain comparison can be made between the American governmental support structure and support structures of West Germany and Japan. It's not clear to me that part of that comparison usually ends up saying that Japanese are better off than Americans because of the competitive advantage that they've gained in the car industry. Japan, as well as the United States, imposes similar kinds of constraints on what they import.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Most countries around the world.
Right. The question is, if we're talking about our position vis-a-vis Japan, and both of us have certain kinds of export and import quotas, can we clearly tie the fact that we're worse off to those export
and
import quotas?
Well, let's for a moment come back, and I want to tie it back into agriculture and ask a question. Let's suppose that we did do everything the automobile industry asked. We cut off imports of automobiles from Japan. Who would suffer?
Those of us who drive Toyotas.
And who else? Yeah, who else?
Farmers. I'm not sure what...
The farmers. You said they were a big export industry.
Oh.
Where does Japan get the money to buy their exports? Japan is a big importer of food from the United States. Where does it get its money?
Well, I agree that they're interconnected. There would also be certain people who might benefit, those who would not be displaced.
Of course, I'm not saying there would be. I didn't say they would. Of course, if you cut off all, the people who would benefit would be the automobile workers, the steel workers in the United States who would produce American cars instead of Japanese cars. The people who would lose, obviously, are the people who buy the cars and drive them. But the thing that's more interesting, and the reason I brought it in this connection, is because of its tie-in with agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
Because I suspect that if you went to farmers, and asked them the question, how would you be affected by increase in the tariff on automobiles? Very few of them would say, my God, that would do me a great deal of harm. For at least 200 years since Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations in 1776, there has been an almost unanimous agreement among economists that tariffs impose a net loss. And that hasn't prevented country after country from having tariffs and adopting them.
We can't guarantee that there will be a tariff-free market for our products
abroad. Of course not. Of course not. And two wrongs don't make a right. It would be better for the world if all the other countries would also go in for no tariffs. But even if they go in for tariffs, we are better off not having tariffs. When you turn to the problem that is so of so much concern to so many people today about how we achieve renewed industrial and economic progress, how we get out of the stagnation that we've been in for the last 10 years with almost no change, no growth in industrial productivity or in output, you get into a whole lot of proposals, many of which are in some ways self-defeating. We have the standard example of the smokestack industry declining, the steel, automobile, and so on. Of the high-tech industries, computers, and so on, rising. So we have proposals on the one hand that you subsidize the high-tech industry, the smokestack industry, so they stay here. You subsidize the high-tech industry so that they can compete, supposedly, with Japan or other high-tech countries. They're self-defeating. And that, in turn, leads everybody to talk about, well, we ought to have a central economic plan which would avoid all these self-defeating things.
I think there's absolutely no sense to any sort of protectionism or subsidization of industry. But I do have a question for you. Given that, I agree with you, what do you do with displaced 40, 50-year-old workers who, for practical purposes, really can't be retrained for another profession or put out of work, say, in the automobile industry?
Maybe you don't do anything about it. What can you do about it?
Well, I don't know. The thing is, if you do provide the subsidy to the industry so these people stay employed, then you're promoting this sort of thing. It just gets worse and worse.
In industries like the automobile industry, we've had, you might say, overemployment because automobile salaries have been so high. One of the reasons that automobile salaries have been so high is that the government has protected automobile workers and steel workers and a few other foreign trade-sensitive industries, they've protected them excessively from the burdens of unemployment because there are special unemployment benefits for people who lose their jobs because of foreign trade. And that has
not been a major factor. It really hasn't.
Well,
the reason why the automobile workers and the steel workers are overpaid is because those were industries which at one time we had a great advantage over other countries in productivity. And therefore, there was a great demand for workers, and the industries were willing to pay high wages. Then you had those industries unionized, and the unions more or less froze those high wages there when the conditions changed for which they were no longer relevant. Today, it is true that the average wage in the automobile and the steel industry is nearly twice as high as the average wage of all workers in the United States.
Okay, but automobile industry workers are now that unemployment is desperate, they're willing to take cutbacks. I was in Detroit 2 years ago interviewing automobile workers, unemployed people, and there wasn't really a whole lot of distress with the idea of being unemployed, because unemployment benefits were so generous that a lot of them were doing perfectly well being unemployed. So there wasn't pressure for giving givebacks in the contracts. If that pressure had come 2 or 3 years earlier, the contracts might have been reasonable enough that unemployment wouldn't be so desperate now.
That may well be true. But now we have a situation now where we have more people in those industries than we are likely to have for a long time. We do have a very real problem that there are people of the kind Harry has talked about who are going to be unemployed. And the question is, what should or could we do about it? When we went out of the business of producing horseless carriages, there were lots of empty carriage factories. All over the West, you'll have deserted gold mines. You know, physical capital. Fundamentally, people have a great misconception. Physical capital is not really very important. What's really important is human capital. Simple example. After World War I, World War II, there was a tremendous destruction of physical capital in Europe. Within 4 or 5 years, those countries were back on target. Because what really was important is not the physical capital, it's the human capital.
Okay, so the problem is making these people switch. I mean, these people are
not making them switch, giving them an opportunity to switch.
Okay. And in my view, the government role is to let them switch as easily as possible.
What can the government do to facilitate that?
First of all, it can make sure that high-tech firms locate in the same place as smokestack industry firms are located.
Even though it's much more expensive to be in those places?
Yeah.
That means fewer jobs all around, doesn't it?
Not if the government can subsidize. Not if the government can make it.
Excuse me, where does the government get the money to subsidize?
Lowell, Massachusetts, I think, is a case where it's worked. Here was an old mill town that was breaking down.
Yeah.
And what city planners did was they made it very attractive, and presumably they had the money to do it. They made it very attractive.
Where did they get
firms,
the money from?
Tax incentives.
Yeah, the problem with all of these things is we tend to look at the benefits from the money. And not to harm to the people who have to pony up the money to do it.
Also, David, in a situation like Lowell, where accepting your facts that the local people did what is necessary, the difference between local economic planning and national economic planning is the method. Local economic planning usually means that the locals cut taxes. Of course, locals, of course, when you cut taxes, it's going to inspire greater economic activity. That's a much different thing than taking tax money from here in the country and putting it somewhere else. There's no reason to believe that on net that's going to increase economic activity. Of course, if you have a tax cut lower, you're going to get more industry.
But go back to your major point. You said that the government should determine the location of the new industries. Just carry out the logic of that. See where that leads you. And see whether you really want to do that.
Well, where does it lead?
It leaves you, as you look through, with an increasingly rigid system in which people are not free. I'm not free. Here's the world. Mr. X wants to set up a plant. Now he can't do it unless he gets permission from the government to set it up somewhere, because they're going to decide where he can set it up.
I'm willing to accept that.
Yeah. You're willing to accept the government should be able to do that? Should be able to tell someone not to set up a plant? Unemployment statistics are very marginal things. I mean, in the worst state in the country, according to federal statistics, West Virginia, there's 20% unemployment.
And there's 80% unemployed.
That's right. In the best state, maybe it's 4%.
Right.
All right. So for the purpose of the 16% differential, you're going to forbid someone to build a plant here rather than here, because this 16% differential entitles you, in your view, to deprive people in this state of jobs so you can give it to people in that state? This is like a very small basis on
which to discriminate. Whom are you kidding? Go stop for a moment. What's going to happen under such a scheme is that the politically powerful states will get plants located in their area and the politically weak states will not.
Look at the current jobs bill.
Exactly.
West Virginia in the current jobs bill is getting $26 million out of nearly $5 billion. It's the worst state in the country. Absolutely the one most in need of help. And it's getting practically the worst treatment of any state in the country.
Here, that jobs bill is a marvelous example. It's supposed to create jobs by repairing what's called the infrastructure. First of all, it isn't creating any jobs, it's destroying jobs because of taxes that are being imposed are destroying more jobs than the spending will create. But in the second place, who's getting the jobs? Not the unemployed. The money is going to the states that are politically powerful, that have the clout, and it's even there, it's being spent on high-paid construction jobs, not on employing the low-paid unemployed. And let's ask a very different question for a moment. Consider these 40 to 50-year unemployed people. No government assistance whatsoever. What happens to them? Do you suppose they don't have a private incentive to try to get jobs of a different kind?
Oh, yes.
Suppose they don't
have
skills?
I'm sure they do.
What's the problem? The problem is very simple. Most of them have been earning a great deal more than they are qualified to earn in alternative skills. And they understandably don't like to see a reduction in their standard of life. I can't blame them for that. But the question is, shouldn't we congratulate them for having been so fortunate and having very high paid jobs for so long? Or should we impose taxes on people who earned much less than they did and who are still earning much less than they did in order to prevent them from having to take jobs earning the same as the rest of the population?
Yeah.
That's, I think, the real issue when you come down to the nitty-gritty of it. And they will not stay unemployed. Most of them have good work habits, many of them.
It's discrimination is certainly something that's talked about. It. I mean, picture yourself an employer. It's easier to train somebody who's going to give you 40 years of good
service.
Absolutely.
And that's why I wouldn't be willing to pay as much. But if you allow the wage rate to be free, what people don't understand is that anybody who is disadvantaged, his main tool, his most effective weapon, is to be willing to work for less.
An investigation started by the state police. They contacted me about 13 months ago. And since then, they've had a number of undercover agents work in the area, trying to make undercover buys, and have been successful in, I think, 29 cases.
It's surely government's business to enforce the laws of the land. But what acts should be illegal? Can making an act illegal do more harm than good? Have we learned anything from that noble experiment, prohibition?
Of all the problems that are bedeviling the American society, one of the most troubling and long-lasting is the problem of crime. Just as a first duty of a government is to defend its country against foreign invaders, surely the second duty is to try to prevent coercion of one citizen by another, to try to hold down crime. Here we are a nation, far wealthier than we have been in earlier days. Surely we ought to be far more capable of providing citizens with the defense against coercion by their fellow citizens. And yet it is widely believed that crime has been on the upgrade and not the downgrade, that we've had more and more of it, and people throughout the country feel more and more threatened by it.
I think it's not the amount of money people have that makes them want to commit crime, or the lack of money they have that makes them want to commit crime, but the perceived inequalities between how much they have and how much other people have, and how much they think they deserve, and how much other people have.
But in that connection also, the inequalities, the perceived inequalities and the actual inequality are very much less today in general than they were 60, 70 years ago.
And very much less at any point in the United States than they were, say, in the 18th century in England, when there was very little crime.
Or very much less today than they are in a place like India, where you will feel safer in walking the street at night in Bombay or Calcutta than you do in walking the street in New York City.
I still maintain that there are two distinct groups in society here in America, the haves and the have-nots. And when the have-nots consistently see the haves as having all the privileges, having all the chances to become great and to have large amounts of material acquisition, these people become disillusioned. They say, we're in America too. We're here. We're citizens. Why is it that we don't live in nice mansions? Why is it that we don't have a car? And why is it that we can't attend Princeton, Harvard, Yale, et cetera, et cetera? Mm-hmm. And once they see these things, they say, well, I can't attain these goals the same way. So therefore, I'll go about it the way I know how. I'll go buy a gun and I'll rob the Cadillac dealer. I'll go get a knife and I'll stick up the business executive. Therefore, I attain his wealth my way.
Yeah, there is a great deal to that. But that has been true all along. And there always have been, at any point in time, the haves and the have-nots. If anything, the ability to move between them has increased and not decreased. So I'm not questioning your statement about that being a source. I just find it hard to attribute the enormous increase in crime to that particular
story. The undermining of the family, I think, has also played a very major role probably in at least the black ghettos in the cities, because as long as you have a certain amount of stability provided for you in an environment where you're trained that certain behavior is simply not socially acceptable, it's you're much more likely to feel as if you are going to behave in the ways that are socially acceptable. And if you're brought up with no notion of that at all, it seems to me that there's no reason why you don't go out and just grab anything that comes your way. To me, in fact, the puzzle is why there are ghetto kids who do pull out of this rather than why nobody does. It seems to me miraculous that some of them decide to be honest.
For a moment, I think it's a great mistake to suppose that crime and the ghetto are synonymous terms. You have an enormous upsurge in crime on the part of middle-class kids. Exactly. If anything, if you make any general statement, crime is a property of young people.
The violent crime of middle-class children and so forth is probably encouraged, especially by the leniency of sentencing at that area, because there, again, the middle class has secured ways of excusing its own from responsibility for their actions.
Now, are you saying, as a matter of, you're saying that the certainty and the severity of punishment has gone down over time?
I believe there's more discretion now in the criminal law than there has been at any other point.
There's something also, though, I think there's been some kind of shift even in societal values at large, which may have something to do with all of this.
But let me take it one step further, because I believe there's a much more than another cause in there that we haven't even touched on. And that is there are more things, more crimes today than there used to be. In the one place, there are more laws to break. But in the second place, if you have a proliferation of laws, in many of which people don't think are right and proper, that encourages a disrespect for law in general. We saw that before the problem of the welfare state arose, if you took it back in the 1920s when you had prohibition. And you had lawlessness emerge in the getting around the Prohibition Amendment. And one of the results of that was a decline in respect for law in general. And so I believe one of the arguments we ought to make against having so many laws, and that one of the most effective, and this is in a way I'm turning to the problem of remedies, that one of the most effective remedies for the problem of crime is to reduce the number of things that are crimes. I believe in free trade. I don't believe there ought to be any tariff laws. I think tariff laws are fundamentally immoral, not moral. And so I don't mind getting rid of tariff laws. Now, a more controversial case is the whole class of what are called victimless crimes. That includes things like drugs. It includes things like prostitution.
Well, let's just take drugs and take these things one at a time. The usual argument, anyways, presented for the abolition of drug laws is prohibition. Prohibition didn't work. But it seems to me that that analogy is utterly fallacious insofar as liquor has been a cultural institution forever. It was widespread when everybody drank when they tried to legalize liquor.
Before 1914, a very large number of people were on drugs. Wasn't illegal at all. Opium and so on could be widely purchased. You know, many of these medicine men who sold medicines were really selling drugs.
Well, in China, it was wide open to opium. They were also wide open to being manipulated by foreign countries because of their dependence on opium.
That's a big leap in the dark about the cause. But I think drugs raise a very interesting question on two different levels. The first level, as a matter of what you regard as just and proper, as ethical, is it right to have laws against drugs? Second, even if you believe it is right, is it expedient to do so? So you have an issue on both the ethical level. And I personally may say my own view is very straightforward. On both levels, I think laws against drugs cannot be justified, except in the very limited sense of protecting young people and juveniles. But if I take adults, tell me, Harry, do you believe in a law against people committing suicide?
Yes.
You do?
Yeah.
You don't believe that people should be free to commit suicide?
No, I believe that one of the primary responsibilities of government is to protect its citizens. And it seems to me protecting them from themselves is what you do with people who are insane. And I don't think that you can say suicide is an entirely personal matter.
The law against suicide in any event is a kind of moral tribute to Western values because it's so ineffectual.
But it brings out the fundamental issue, because I think it's the easiest way to separate people who have two very widely different sets of values. See, I don't view government the way you do at all. I view government as a way in which we jointly do certain things together that it would be difficult or impossible for us to do separately. It's an instrument through which we achieve our values. It is not something that's going to impose its values on us. And I agree, those are two very different philosophical views of the role of government, and both of them, I may say, have very respectable and honorable sponsors, so there's nothing wrong with them.
The problem with drugs, and this is an old argument, I recognize that drugs have aspects of contagious diseases. They are addictive, they spread through communities quickly.
I think on the same grounds you're prepared to ban Marx's Das Kapital from publication. It surely has killed and done an enormous more people and done an enormous amount more harm than all the drugs that anybody has ever ingested.
Well, if you could make me a good argument that banning Das Kapital would have prevented that damage, would have eliminated Soviet Russia and Communist China,
I can't. And the reason I can't is because if you once accept the principle that it's okay to ban Das Kapital on those grounds, then it's also okay to ban anything else.
Because you're reducing decision-making to a completely formal level. You're putting us on this slippery slope. In fact, we can think about things and we can decide that banning Das Kapital is okay, but banning something about Galbraith
who
isn't.
Who is a we? Who is a we who can think that way?
Men thinking about problems and making these decisions.
But you mean there's going to be some governmental official who will make the decision?
There is no escape.
There's not going to be a vote.
There is no escape from making decisions. And setting up these formal protections is an attempt to avoid these decisions. You and I can distinguish between heroin and marijuana. And there's no point, really, to our giving ourselves up to that formal decision that we're not going to have any rules against drugs, rather than making the better judgment that we're going to eliminate the bad ones and leave in the not so bad.
If our aim is controlled drug use and to try and minimize the use of drugs because we think the effect is harmful and we think it's appropriate for us to determine what another individual can do to harm his or her body, there are more effective means to do that. Britain, for example, controls its heroin addiction rate in a much more effective manner than the United States. I think the statistics in the two countries are quite clear that a legalized method, legalizing the use to a certain extent, registering the heroin addicts, and having a government dispensing system for heroin, both controls the rate of growth of heroin addiction and minimizes the concomitant crime problem, which is produced by making heroin addiction illegal.
So you would make the case that legalization might cause a decline in the number of drug users?
I think that if what we're concerned about is a decline in the number of drug users, that's precisely what we need to do.
Legalization, look, let me give you a very different argument, Harry. With drugs illegal, there is a market incentive for a drug pusher to create addicts. If I'm a drug pusher and you're a potential addict, I can afford to give you some free samples to get you hooked. Because once you're hooked, you're going to be a captive customer. But the other expediential argument, the other side of that argument, is that prohibiting drugs, by all evidence, accounts that the drug addicts and drug addiction accounts for something like half of all major crimes of violence. Because those crimes are produced by people who are hooked, who don't have enough money to buy their next dose, and who go out and steal and so on in order to get the money. And they have to do that because drugs are so incredibly expensive, and they are expensive because they're illegal, because we interfere with them. If you had a legal source of drugs at relatively low prices, which they would be, you would, it seems to me, drastically eliminate this whole category of crime.
The losers are not only the poor. They're the taxpayers as well. As a matter of fact, according to the figures that I've seen, it cost $22,000 per unit to rehabilitate these buildings in 1970. And if you just gave the people the money, you would be able to give them $22,000. And they would surely be able to do better managing their own lives rather than having some bureaucrat in Washington manage their lives like this.
The
Economist Walter Williams grew up in the slums of Philadelphia.
In one sense, we won the war on poverty, in one sense, but we've lost abysmally the war on independence. That is, we have a number of people around Mott Haven and other places in the country who have television sets, who have telephones, who are receiving reasonable medical care, but they are highly dependent. That is, they are locked in that position for life.
There's a tremendous tyranny of the status quo. And what is right, and people take it for granted. And it's exactly this tyranny of the status quo that makes it so difficult for us to do anything about these things. What happens, as you know, is that every class that gets a benefit gets something for it, regards it as an inalienable right that they're under no circumstances are willing to give up in any way. And that's the difficulty of reforming it.
It seems to me that one of the reasons, one of the components of the dissatisfaction with administrations previous to Reagan and which led to Reagan's election was not a total spending question, but a distribution question. The food stamps program, for example, was not passed because the poor are incredibly good lobbyists. It's passed because people in this society in general have a genuine interest in making it possible for everyone in this society to eat. That program also was not passed simply because agriculture wanted it. Agriculture wins regardless of how those people acquire the means to eat. As long as they eat, agriculture wins. The question raised by food stamp programs and a variety of social programs which benefit very small, the lowest sectors of this society, has to do with the distribution of the costs among all sectors of society. And I think that that's an important issue among the American public.
Well, if you look at what the facts are in respect to this, it's extremely difficult to identify the burden on each individual, each class, because so many of our taxes, and not unintentionally, are in a form in which it's hard to know who pays for it. You will hear all the people talking about, we have to have taxes on business. But business can't pay any taxes. Business collects taxes on behalf of the government from its workers, from its customers, and from its stockholders. It doesn't pay taxes, it collects them. And so when you take those taxes and say, what income classes bore the burden of them? It's an extremely difficult job, but there have been many studies that have been made. And it's a fascinating thing that almost all those studies suggest that the actual burden of taxes is more or less proportional across income classes. Nonetheless, I think you're right, because what matters is not what the facts are, but what the perceptions are. And everybody in the society believes that he's bearing an unfair share of the burden. The low-income people feel that, the middle-income people feel that, and the high-income people feel that.
That's where I think the answer to getting a hold on the budget lies is in Reagan's undercutting the coalition of opinion makers, or the people that Irving Kristol has called the new class, and the Democratic Party. If Ronald Reagan put the emphasis onto passing a balanced budget amendment, it seems to me that would be a very hard issue to campaign against and a very easy issue to campaign.
If you take for the moment what the facts are on that, the balanced budget amendment that actually was before the Senate and the House was a balanced budget and tax limitation amendment. It got a two-thirds vote in the Senate. It got more than a majority vote in the House, but not a two-thirds vote. So that you can see that there is, and I may say, it got those votes in the Senate and the House, despite the fact that I doubt that there are many senators or House members who really favored it, because they think wrongly that it reduces their power. And it got that vote only because it was so popular in the public at large.
I'd just like to add a consideration which I think should be taken into account when addressing the balanced budget question. One of the actions that Reagan has taken, or Reagan in conjunct with Congress has taken, which has added to the perception of unequal distribution, was that his tax cuts, in fact, accorded the highest percentage decrease in tax to the highest income bracket.
That's true.
So those kinds of activities don't do anything to alleviate the perception, I think, that's widely held among the
American population. You're quite right about that.
And that has to be addressed before the balanced budget proposal, I think, could...
Well, you're quite right about that perception. But the perception is wrong. and right, it's both. The drop, the cut in the top rate from 70% to 50%, undoubtedly, reduced the cost of those taxes to the high-income people. But I believe it increased the revenue received by the government because it reduced the attractiveness of tax shelters.
There are figures on that, by the way, now. It took them a while to come in, but apparently the 70 to 50% cut produced something on the order of a 10% increase in revenue from affected taxpayers.
Well, I think when you look at the core of why we're spending too much outside of what the public really wants, I think it's not the opinion makers that are distorting what the public wants. I think it's the way things are set up. And in theory, what Hamilton, Jay, and Madison said in the Federalist Papers was that opposing factions would counterbalance each other and a compromise would be worked out. But in reality, I think we've seen is that's not what happens. I think there are two different types of things that happen. One is that less powerful factions don't send anybody to Washington, and powerful factions do. So to take an example, tobacco growers send a lobby to Washington. Nobody is going to oppose them, so the congressmen listen to them because they want to make friends with the tobacco growers because they're very powerful. So they give the tobacco growers money. Now the taxpayers don't know anything about it because it only costs each of them a dollar or two. So they don't even read it in the newspapers. Now the second thing—
But you know, it's interesting, before you go on, there is also a lobby that provides that the Surgeon General should spend tax money to discourage people from smoking. Now, that's also a special interest lobby. And it's perfectly reasonable in terms of this political view that should be so, because there's a special interest for something.
Yeah.
There's a special interest for tobacco subsidies. There's a special interest against tobacco subsidies, and you have to satisfy both.
One solution that's been proposed to the problem of these interest groups being so successful in lobbying is to limit the amount of money that they can contribute to individual candidates' campaigns. And that way, their influence over the political process would be limited. And that way, supposedly, it is argued, the poor and the rich would be able to compete equally effectively or somewhat more effectively. And there are various bills to limit the contributions of political action committees, for example, to individual candidates' campaigns.
Yeah, I think the problem of PACs and special interests are a little bit overstated. I think that PACs are aesthetically undesirable, but they don't have all that much effect, as was shown in the last congressional election, where NCPAC was basically a failure. I go along with Ben Wattenberg, more or less, in saying that the PACs are a junk mail democracy. You get this thing in the mail, you want to send $25 to whoever, you do it. I don't really understand why liberals, as a matter of course, are opposed to special interest groups, because what's the real difference between a special interest group in Washington and a union in a business?
Well, but if we've just agreed that the major political problem is factionalism, then if there's a way of limiting people's ability to form factions, it seems very desirable to go ahead and do that.
There's no doubt it's desirable to reduce factionalism. But the fundamental problem with the kind of proposal you're suggesting, the problem of limiting contributions, is that the real source of factionalism is the fact that the government has enormously valuable grants to give. It has privileges to dispense. As long as there are privileges there to dispense, as long as there's a kind of a governmental gold mine, there will be plenty of explorers going after it. It's like a river. If you block up one channel, it goes another channel. You have to find some way to block up the whole river. What's happened? Why did PACs develop? Because we blocked up certain channels of contributions by individuals, and PACs developed as an offset to that. In my opinion, it's undesirable to have any limit on political contributions by individuals out of their own money. I think there's a great deal to be said that you ought not to let businesses, perhaps, spend money on this way. There are various arguments, but so far as individuals are concerned, it seems to me this is simply a First Amendment proposition that people ought to be free to express their view. If they want to express their view by working for a candidate, manning a telephone bank and doing the many other things that volunteers do, fine. If they want to express their views by giving you money, fine.
But if you but you're not going to succeed in stopping factionalism by blocking up one of these channels. All you're going to do is to direct the ingenuity of the people into finding other ways.
So that instead of trying to change it so that some group can't rig the system, you want to set up a system that can't be rigged at all?
Insofar as possible. I think that the limitations on campaign spending are band-aids, and they don't really attack the fundamental problem.
Maybe part of the problem is that the benefits to all of the interest groups which get the spending are very large and are very immediate for them, and they have a tremendous incentive, therefore, to pressure congressmen to vote for those sorts of programs. But the cost of any single program spread out over the taxpayers seems relatively minor, and therefore they may not have a similar incentive to lobby against that particular program.
The question is, how do we alter the system to get rid of this bias, which arises out of the point that Steve is making, that the benefits go to a small, of each program separately, go to a small select group, while the costs are spread widely. And therefore, the beneficiaries have more political clout than the recipients. The people who are going to pay the taxes, as you said before, are dispersed and few. Maybe it's going to cost each one $5 extra. Nobody's going to go down in Washington and scream about that $5. And so the problem, the political problem, is how can you get this thing treated as a package in which people can vote on the thing as a whole and then break it down?
In the kind of governmental system that we have, there seems to be a natural tendency toward this, because people who can express their strength at the polls are the ones who are likely to be strongly benefited by something. And it's always been the case, I think, in democracies of unlimited power, that the greatest concern has been a certain segment of the population just going out and voting itself benefits.
One thing which might improve the situation would be if we restructured the incentives for the federal legislative process so that congressmen, when they voted on these bills, would be able to take into account the problems of the incentive to spend. And one way of doing that would be to set an overall cap on spending that would force congressmen to apportion a fixed amount of the national income instead of having the possibility of constantly letting spending increase. Another possibility might be to have an item veto or a two-thirds requirement for passing appropriations or tax bills.
Well, it's interesting, if you go back to the Federalist Papers and the Founding Fathers, they were very much concerned about the problem of faction. They were concerned exactly about this kind of a problem. And it was in that conception that they were interested in having a system of checks and balances, and particularly in leaving power with the separate states on the grounds that the possibility of one state doing that was much more limited than the possibility of the society as a whole doing it. And of course, one of the things that has facilitated the movement we've had has been the centralization of power in the federal government. And one of the things, again, it's interesting, one of the things that Mr. Reagan was very strongly in favor of was a new federalism which would turn more power back to the states. And that, too, has made no progress.
We live in a global economy, and we need a national policy to protect our industrial base, not for protectionism, as they talk of it, not for doing away with an uncompetitive situation, but rather taking the Japanese practices, let's say, translating them from Japanese into English.
We ought to move into those countries and challenge the causes of revolution, challenge the hunger and the poverty and the repression, and line up with the genuinely revolutionary forces that merely want democratic institutions and human rights.
Of all the candidates for president, I've had the most experience and background in trade. I'm committed to a more open international competitive environment, but I also know what's going on.
As voters, we have heard it all before, and yet we approach each election with new hope. Surely this time, the candidate whom we elect will give us what we want. Why is it easier to get what we want when we buy something in the marketplace than when we elect a candidate? For example, more and more people decided to reduce their caffeine consumption, and suddenly there were caffeine-free colas on all the grocery shelves. Will we ever get that kind of service from our government?
How can the entire citizenry be the master of their circumstances under a socialist government?
It's democratic socialism.
Well, you have 51% of the people vote for one thing and 49% vote for the other. Mm-hmm. Are the 49% who voted against it masters of their own destiny?
Nor am I going to defend the efficiency of democracy. But as Winston Churchill says, it's better than anything else.
Well, maybe for those things for which you have to have a single decision. Yeah. But isn't it far better to have a world in which the 51% can get what they vote for and the 49% can get what they vote for?
The question is whether that kind of world is possible.
Right.
Well, let me ask you, when people go into, people vote every day in this country. They vote several times a day. When you go into a store and buy something, you're voting. When you order food in a restaurant, you're voting. And when you vote that way, you're almost always getting what you voted for.
But not what they want. What Nobody gets what they want in the market.
Of course they do.
This is
they don't get all they want.
Of course not. The world is finite. But in terms of what you actually are getting, surely, when you go into a store and decide to buy a pound of potatoes, you get a pound of potatoes.
But it's not clear when you buy a bag of potatoes what things you lose by purchasing that bag. I'm talking about the following kind of situation. The market, in fact, tracks the demand for particular goods. Is that not
absolutely
a claim that's uncontroversial at this table? Okay. If you use land to grow potatoes, you might give up the possibility of having sweet potatoes or whatever else
not
you
at all.
Land.
Not at all.
They vote for potatoes. It's not clear by the fact that they buy potatoes that they don't want sweet potatoes next week.
Maybe, but then they will for next week vote for sweet potatoes.
Not a sweet
potato. The respect in which you have a valid point. Is if I am if my purchase has effects on third parties, which I'm not able to compensate them for. If, for example, you are voting for more electricity by buying electricity, that leads to more smoke coming out of the chimney of the smokestack of the public utility company, and that dirties my shirt. Then you have a valid point that your action is imposing costs on me that I didn't agree to. But in the main, for things like potatoes and sweet potatoes, that problem is, in fact, not a major real problem at all.
When we make a collective political decision in a voting booth or in a general election, we're making a decision about how society should be. When we make a consumer decision, we don't care about how society should
be. Let's go to the first. No, we're actually making a decision that certain specific people shall have power. Now, as I've repeated several times, many times in various occasions, if I were to be sitting opposite an IRS inspector who is inspecting my tax returns. Technically speaking, he's my servant and I'm the master. Which way, what would you feel about it? Which way would you feel if you were sitting in that position as a taxpayer, not as the IRS servant? In fact, what you are doing when you vote in the booth is transferring arbitrary power, largely arbitrary power
still
in many cases.
Still rests in the lap of the voter. I mean, I'm making a voluntary...
I beg your pardon. You're buying a whole package, some of which you want to buy and some of which you don't.
Right.
My claim is that when I go into the grocery store, if we're talking about me picking out the life I want and the goods I want, in order for me to make an informed decision about buying any particular product, I have to know exactly what market forces follow from me buying that product. And that's not clear from
you
the purchase
not.
Of potatoes.
You do not. You do
you
not. You are
do.
One. It's exactly the same as in the political booth. You're one vote in the political booth. You're one vote in the market. You're a very small vote in the market. The consequences of what you do are borne entirely by you. You have earned a dollar by spending 5 minutes doing something, or 10 minutes, or whatever it is. And what you are doing is trading that 10 minutes of your time for the time of all the people who are involved in producing this 1 pound of potatoes. And there are essentially no further things you have to take into account.
I think we keep changing what's really a collective question, central planning, and putting it in individual terms, and I think we're warping the question when we do that.
Well, when you say it's a collective question, this comes back to the question of what you mean by collective. We have a society.
Right.
But that society is a collection of individuals. And fundamentally, I think what we're interested in is how these decisions affect individuals. Now, as members of a society,
there are
certain values we have in common, certain features of our total society that we benefit from or we harm, or we are harmed by, insofar as there's a wide measure of agreement about that, it's fine. Insofar as there are sharp differences, we would like to have a world in which people have as much freedom as possible to live their own kinds of style.
Yeah, obviously.
But I think it confuses things to think of collective as one thing, or collective. There isn't one collective. There are people's connections with their church, people's connection with their family, people's connection with their local community, with the society as a whole. There are a whole hierarchy of these kinds of collective
still,
growth.
As a nation, we move in directions, I think it's fair to say. And I think what Carol is saying is that when we buy potatoes and when everybody buys potatoes, we don't really think in what directions we're moving, and we move in whatever directions the market takes us.
The market doesn't take you anyplace. The market is a means and an instrument whereby we engage in deals with one another. We're the ones who are taking us. And fortunately, when we buy potatoes, we aren't moving society in one way or the other. All we're doing is providing an opportunity for people who want to grow potatoes to satisfy our desire for potatoes. Now, in fact, the market mechanism extends much beyond buying and selling. Now, buying and selling is a case where it is largely transactions among individuals. The fact that a group of people got together and set up, let's say, a nonprofit voluntary hospital, that was a collective action by a group of people. The Red Cross was a collective creation. That's as much a creation of the market, of individual transactions, as growing and selling potatoes. The crucial question in every case that I would bring to it is it voluntary? Are people free to join or not free to join?
I'm curious about your definition of freedom. And would you say somebody is free who has no money?
Absolutely. We don't want to confuse freedom and power. Let me give you a simple example. Robinson Crusoe is on an island. He is very, very poor.
Yes.
The island is a bad island. Would you say he's unfree?
Sure.
I would. I say he's poor. I think it's very important to use our terms to separate freedom, which I would interpret as having to do with relations among individuals. I would define freedom as the absence of coercion, and coercion as the use by one person of another person as his instrument, as a means rather than an end in itself. And I think it's important to distinguish freedom, which is an absence of coercion, from power, which is a capacity to command goods and services.
But
the person who doesn't have anything to eat, what?
Isn't poverty a coercion?
No, no, no. Coercion is always by people against people. Mm. Now, if I come, you have food, and I steal it from you, then I have coerced you, yes. That's why I give you the Robinson Crusoe case. He hasn't been coerced by anybody. He hasn't lost any freedom. He's very poor. He doesn't have much to eat. But he hasn't been coerced.
Even accepting your definition of freedom, or to accept your definition of freedom, argues in favor of something which I'm not willing to concede. That is, it's under your analysis, the most important thing is that people, whatever the people do, they do voluntarily.
Absolutely.
I think I'm starting out from the position that I think it's the society I want to live in has people have the most equal endowment of certain kinds of material goods which aid fulfilling a particular career objective or the like.
And I guess I would be saying that that kind of society is immoral, and I think if you saw the results of it, you would feel it was immoral because it would necessarily have to work to make people the same and to eliminate all the differences among people, which are some of the things that we value the most.
And I would say that I want you both to be able to have your voice.
Because if you want to live in such a society, I think you ought to be able to live in such a society, but I don't think you ought to make him live in one. And the way to have that is by local self-government. You and people who feel like you should organize a community. There are communes in the United States that are organized exactly on that principle. You ought to be absolutely free to have them. You ought to be free to join them. The question is, I want you to be free to make Steve live in such a society if he doesn't want to. We are not saying that we want people to starve. We are saying that the kind of world we want is one in which we believe fewer people will starve, fewer people will have deficient housing and so on, but that's a byproduct and not the primary objective. The primary objective for me is a society in which there's a minimum of coercion of some people by other people, in which you have a maximum of freedom. Now, I happen to believe that historical evidence and analysis alike suggests that such a society will, in fact, be far more prosperous.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.